Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. This week on the program, former Utah Attorneys General Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow make their first court appearance. What legal strategies will they use as they defend against corruption charges? Rocky Mountain Power is pushing for a new fee, saying it's only fair that homeowners with solar panels pay for their use of the grid. But opponents say it punishes those who support alternative energy. How will the Public Service Commission respond? And a group of Utah libertarians is taking on the Common Core in court. Why go the legal route instead of through politics? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got Shurtleff and Swallow in court, national monuments, homophones, and much more. And joining me this morning, Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke back in the studio. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. How are
also
you?
With us is columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Justice reporter Marissa Lang is here, too. Welcome back.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And government reporter Matt Canham is here as well. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too, if there's a news story that you want to talk about. You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on the website sltrib.com. You can also call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's dive right into the scandal that continues to rock this state. Shurtleff and Swallow, two former Utah attorneys general, going to court for the first time this week. Robert, remind us, what charges are they facing?
Well, there's 23 counts altogether. Swallow's got 11 felonies and two misdemeanors he's charged with, and former attorney general Shurtleff has 10 felonies. They range from accepting unlawful gifts, soliciting or receiving bribes, obstruction of justice, tampering with witnesses, things like that. So it sort of runs the gamut. I mean, they've got, but you know, going into the courtroom, both of them said that you know they didn't do what they were accused of having done, and they're going to beat the charges. They seem pretty adamant that they're ready for the fight. Former Attorney General Shurtleff acknowledged that this is taking a toll on his family at this point, taking a toll on him financially as well. But he said he's relieved that he finally gets to, start making the case in court that he's an innocent person. So, you know, this was this hearing that that Marissa and I were at this week was very brief. I mean, they just set another date for August 18th for an August 18th hearing. And, former Attorney General Shurtleff said he thinks that this is going to take about 18 months for discovery and preliminary motions and everything like that, and then 5 to 6 weeks of trial. So this is all far from over at this point.
I guess from my vantage point, this was very interesting as a spectacle. I mean, mm-hmm. because we saw images that we hadn't seen before. We saw Shurtleff and Swallow together in the same room, and it's been months since that's happened.
Yeah, Mark said going into, you know, as we were talking, as we were going into the courtroom, you know, I said, "Is this, when was the last time you saw him?" And he saw John, and he said it had been months. He said the last time except for, I guess, they sort of briefly, you know, made eye contact when they were in jail after their arrest. So outside of that sort of brief, you know, fleeting glance, you know, this was the first time they've actually been in the same room. And Marissa mentioned that they were sort of greeting each other.
They sat in the same row towards the front of the courtroom. And when Mark Shurtleff walked in, he, you know, greeted John. They shook hands. They kind of exchanged pleasantries. Shurtleff's family was there. His daughter and his wife were joining him that day. So, you know, John Swallow said hello to them, asked them how they were doing. It was very friendly, but also just very, hello, how are you, good morning, nothing much beyond that.
Other than the two prime characters in this continuing saga, what was the atmosphere in the courtroom like, Marissa?
I mean, it was a very packed courtroom that day for a couple reasons. And it's a generally busy schedule when you have a first appearance calendar. There's a lot of defendants who come in that day. But there was also tons of media. You could tell that the attorneys in the room were watching to see what had happened. When when that happened, when Mark Shurtleff walked in and shook John Swallow's hand, I was sitting right up in the front, and I could hear that the lawyers at the front of the room kind of quieted. People noticed. I think everybody knew what they were witnessing was a pretty big deal.
Hmm. Why did they appear together, Robert?
Well, I think that was mostly just a scheduling issue. As they were going into the courtroom, Shurtleff said that they're going to make a motion to separate the cases. He said the reason for that is the things that he's accused of having done are different than the things John is accused of having done, so they want to stand trial separately. They were both assigned to Judge Ruby Mills. My hunch, and I'm not basing this on anything that either side has told me, is that they'll look, both sides will probably look for a different judge, because she's handling the Mark Sessions Jensen case, Mark Sessions Jensen is one of the people who, one of the leading witnesses, one of the leading accusers, I guess, of both Shurtleff and Swallow. So I suspect we'll, between now and maybe not before August 18th, but sometime shortly after, we'll probably see a motion to assign a new judge to the case.
I think Robert's right, but also just to clarify, they are co-defendants right now, and yeah. So co-defendants almost always will appear at the same first appearance. They're going to be appearing together for as long as they are co-defendants. So until one or both of them tries to get their case split off from the other, we're going to see them both in the same courtroom every time.
Right.
You mentioned that Shurtleff made some statements talking about a plea bargain. He was answering some questions. He insisted the plea bargain really not in the works, right, Robert?
He said that he's not going to plead anything because there's nothing to plead to. He says he's an innocent person and is going to go fight the charges, fight the charges and prove that he's an innocent person. So, yeah, he said there's no plea talks in the works. And Swallow, I don't believe, was asked that question, but, it looks like their posture right now is that they're going to go ahead with, and pursue the case.
Swallow's attorney, Steve McCoy, has told me numerous times basically the same thing, that they're not pleading because there's nothing to plead to.
It's interesting the different tacks they are taking, though, because Shurtleff still seems to be very much in the media, very comfortable in that environment. Swallow, more direct, more brief. And Marissa, what did he say to the media?
He just said that, I forget the direct quote off the top of my head right now, but he essentially said that he's innocent and that's what he's going to prove in court. And he basically said one thing and then took off.
It was interesting because I think what he said is the things that I've been accused of. I didn't do the things I've been accused of.
I didn't do the things that I've been accused of. Yeah, that was it.
Which is an interesting posture for both of them to be taking at this point, because between the House investigation, the Lieutenant Governor's investigation, the work we've done, there's audio tapes of some of these meetings. They've acknowledged at different times that they have done the things that they're accused of having done. The question that the prosecutors are going to be asked is this a crime? That's what they're going to have to prove, and that's what the defense attorneys are going to have to show, that no, this doesn't meet the letter of the law, this doesn't violate the letter of the law. And so even if they've acknowledged having done these things, taking the houseboat, taking the plane, taking these gifts, then that doesn't necessarily constitute a crime. That's going to be the defense challenge.
Mm. Marissa, as you've spoken with the attorneys, are they concerned about getting a fair trial here in Salt Lake County? This story has just dominated news coverage for, I don't know, well over a year.
Absolutely. Forget Salt Lake County. They're worried about getting a fair trial anywhere in the state. Several of the attorneys I've spoken to have said, usually when you have a high-profile case, the solution is to move to a different county. It's to either move the case to a different county or bring in a jury from a different county. And in this case, that doesn't really solve the problem because, like you said, it's been so publicized and it's something that is not about a Salt Lake County specific politician or Salt Lake County specific case. These are state politicians. It's very high profile and it's really affected and I think enthralled the entire electorate to see what happens. So you're kind of looking at the same issue of a jury knowing and being biased in pretty much whatever county you take this case to.
Hmm. Enthralling the public. What about lawmakers, policymakers, insiders? How's this playing on Capitol Hill, Robert?
Well, I think the overwhelming sentiment I heard after the arrest and the charges were filed was that it's about time. I think a lot of the people up there, up at the Capitol, were of the opinion that, yeah, they're going to get charged. It's just, it's just a question of when, and they were hoping it would be sooner rather than later. There isn't a lot of support for either of these guys up there anymore, some of the legislators have now sort of shifted and are looking ahead to, reform measures that they can take, that they're going to be proposing during the upcoming session, things that, you know, with these scandals, it's always, you know, closing the barn door after the cows are out, I guess, but they're going to, things that they can do to keep things, keep a scandal or a situation like this from happening again. So there will be some proposals up there this coming session. You know, they've done some things, kind of plucked some of the low-hanging fruit, things that were easier for them to do last session. And so, but yeah, I mean, I also think that there's sort of a sense that they want to show that this is limited to these two guys. This is a Swallow Shirtliff problem. This is not a Utah political problem. And whether or not they can build that firewall and maintain that firewall, I guess we have to wait until November to see.
I'm just going off of the photo gallery and the videos that you guys posted on sltrib.com, but it seemed to me that Swallow was flanked by his attorneys. Shirtliff had his wife and daughter there, Marissa.
He did, yes. His teenage daughter and his wife were both with him during the appearance.
Is this the daughter that was at the Shirtliff home when investigators came and seized some evidence?
Yes, it's the same girl. She's kind of been peripherally in the public eye throughout this whole thing. She also greeted him. There was photos in, I think, everywhere after Swallow and Shirtliff were arrested and then released from Salt Lake County Jail, of Shirtliff's daughter going to greet him as he was exiting the jail and walking toward basically a huge crowd of reporters, of which I was a part. So she's kind of been in and out of the public eye, I think, throughout this
and
whole affair.
She kind of, the day of the trial, she tweeted a picture of her with her dad with a little, holding a sign that said #justice.
#justice.
So, you know, she's... you know, whether she's doing this on her own or whether her father is sort of putting her out there to kind of bolster the public sympathy, I guess
there's been a lot of criticism about
that. There's been a lot of criticism, right? So, you know, I mean, she's been by his side throughout, and I guess will continue to be, it appears.
Prosecutors asking for a speedy trial. What's the next phase, Marissa?
The next phase is they will appear, I think Robert already said this, but they will appear August 18th before Judge Ruby Mills. And that right now is just set up as a scheduling conference. And what that means is they're going to set some dates. The next big step is the preliminary hearing. And at the preliminary hearing is when we and the public really for the first time are going to get to hear the prosecution lay out the nuts and bolts of its case. It's never the complete case that one would see presented to a jury, but they're going to lay out the nitty-gritty of why they believe they have probable cause to charge these two individuals with what they have charged them with. So they're going to try to, you know, cross their T's and dot their I's and go through each charge and explain, this is why we believe they're guilty of X, and this is why we believe they're guilty of Y. And they're going to take the judge through the entire thing. They're going to call witnesses. They're going to present evidence. I think we don't know yet how long a preliminary hearing in this case might take, but it could take as long as a week. And after that, a judge has to decide if he or she is persuaded. And if so, then that judge will order Swallow and Shirtliff to stand trial, and then we start the march towards an actual trial before a jury.
History in the making. I know you guys will continue to follow. I want to move on to another story that it went surprisingly viral. An employee at a language school was apparently fired over the use of a simple word, homophone. And Paul Raleigh, tell us what happened at the Norman Global Language Center.
Well, this was a guy, his name was Tim Torkelson, and he was hired coincidentally on April Fool's Day of this year. He was hired to be their first, excuse me, social media guy. They hadn't had
one
before.
He's a blogger, right?
Right. And so they wanted to have the social media person to kind of get their name out there more. Now the owner told me that when I called him that this was kind of a last straw thing, that the guy had been a little out there and kind of a loose cannon a little bit. But he did acknowledge that, you know, he decided to fire him finally because of he did a blog explaining this is a language school and it's for foreign language people, students. It's been around for about 15 years. It's the largest private foreign language school in Utah. They basically there to prepare foreign students to, you know, get them ready to as far as their English grammar skills go, to go to college. And He was upset about the use of the, you know, all it was explaining the term homophone, which is, you know, it's a word that sounds exactly the same as a different word, but they have
witch.
A different meaning. Yeah. And he was explaining that concept because it's kind of unique to the English language. But just the term homophone made the owner feel that people are going to look at that and think that they're pro-gay rights or something. And I mean, it was pretty kind of the whole thing was kind of silly. The interesting thing is somebody else, they had a thing on their website in 2011 explaining homophone. And that wasn't an issue at the time. But I believe things are so, you know, charged now because of the same-sex ruling, by Judge Shelby, has really put this issue to the forefront. This school is based in Provo, and you can make your own assumptions. Provo is a kind of a hotbed of the anti-same-sex marriage movement, and so I think this guy might have been sensitive about that. I was actually surprised at how viral this story went. I mean, it's gone all over the place. It's had,
the Daily Mail in the UK, Newsweek. Yeah. I mean, how does Utah dig out of this one?
Well, it's a good question. I actually watched Jon Stewart last night just to see if he might have it on. But, that seems to me to be the kind of thing he would have fun with. But I don't know how it's just Utah again, getting in the national, maybe even international news over some silly thing like that. I did get one of the commenters on the column said it's a good thing you didn't do a blog explaining Homo erectus. That would have given them a heart attack.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh. Also with us, reporters Robert Gerke, Marissa Ling, and Matt Canham. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. And you can join us as well, the number 801-355-TALK. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, columnist Paul Raleigh and reporters Marissa Lang, Matt Canham, and Robert Gerke. And we're talking about the week's top stories. If you want to join us, send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. And Matt, let's turn to you. A group of senators sending a letter to President Obama with the message, preserve Greater Canyonlands. Who sent the letter? What did it say?
We had 14 liberal senators, 13 Democrats, and one independent that caucuses with the Democrats, who pressed the president to create this national monument that would cover 1.8 million acres. And there is nothing that irritates Utah members of Congress more than having senators from Illinois and New Jersey say, this is what we should do to protect lands in Utah. This is something that Utah's members of Congress have been worried about and have been trying to fight against for years.
And why now? Why did this group of senators decide this was the time to send that message?
Because this is the time when environmental groups like SUA asked them to. This is a point in the negotiations where they think this is one of the greatest chances they have to protect this land. There's been some hope that Representative Rob Bishop will create some deal that would strike a balance between what land to protect and what land to drill on. And that is kind of just stalled out. There's still talks going on, but they don't seem to be progressing very far. So the way you put pressure is you get the president to at least think about protecting this land unilaterally. Each president since the 1906 Antiquities Act has the ability to just designate land as a national monument. And Obama's done it a handful of times, but it's always been on non-controversial land. This would be remarkably controversial.
And why is it so controversial? Because it's in Utah, and we have a track record of being miffed by presidents who put in national monuments in the state's borders?
Yes.
Okay.
Remind us,
what happened
in
1996?
We were upset when Clinton did this with the Gran Escalante National Monument. And it's for the same reason, that there's a fight over whether this land should be protected or if there's parts of this land that can be mined for energy development. And in this state, you have a lot of politicians who want to use that land in that way. They look at it as a way to boost revenue, a way to get this country to energy independence, and there's a fundamental shift on what can be used. Then you have environmental groups that just say the whole thing should be protected. It is vital land that has been a cornerstone of the state. It's why people come to the state, and this is the biggest parcel of land in the lower 48 states that doesn't have roads on it.
Well, tell us a bit more about the features of Greater Canyonlands. Where precisely is this? Does it abut other national monuments? Or?
So it surrounds the Canyonland National Park. There already is, but this is a huge portion of land around it, and it's in southeastern Utah above the Navajo Nation, but it still has some land that's very important to the Navajos there. And the Navajo Nation has also asked the president to create this national monument because Congress appears to have no ability to act on this. And so there's these beautiful mesas, archaeological, thank you, wonders in this area that they want to protect.
President Obama, is he in the mood to do this? We know that he did a national monument pretty recently. Any sense that he's looking at Utah, that he's sort of targeted this area prior to this communication from the senators?
Utah's members of Congress think that he's looking at it. They're really worried about it. There's also pressure like this that shows that there's some support, whether it's from Orrin Hatch and Rob Bishop, or in this case, Dick Durbin and Elizabeth Warren. There is support, and so they are worried about it. The president also actually said he was more interested in doing some national monuments in his last State of the Union address. Now, would this happen before a midterm election? That seems highly unlikely.
Well, that's sort of the interesting parallel, too, though. You mentioned the Grand Staircase Escalante in 1996. I mean, that was done leading up to a midterm election and was seen by some of the conservatives as a sop to the environmental community to kind of get them on board. I think there's one potential cause for concern from some of Utah's congressional delegation is maybe this is history repeating themselves. You know, you could have Barack Obama standing down in southern Utah or northern Arizona creating this giant monument right before an election to sort of invigorate the base.
What I'm surprised by, Representative Bishop has been sort of brokering this deal, this middle position between development and conservation. He's been working pretty closely with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance as part of that coalition, hasn't he?
He's been working with environmental groups. That group has been a little bit harder to deal with because they're historically been more litigious and more aggressive on the legislative front. But he has been working with the Wilderness Society and Sierra Club. He has talked with Sue as part of this group. But what it comes down to is if these issues were easy to negotiate, we would have dealt with them decades ago. This is an entrenched fight within two different, you know, political spheres, and they have a real hard time looking at the same acre of land and saying that should be protective, that should have an oil rig on it.
Do you think that this particular move by the senators will sort of splinter that loosely based coalition that Bishop's been trying to form?
I don't think so at this stage. I think that this fear is one of the reasons Rob Bishop has went this route, is that he's worried that Obama will do this. There is nothing stopping the president from doing this. It's not like he needs Utah in any sort of political way. It's not like there's a deal that he can be, you know, negotiated with. He could do this if he feels, like Gerke said, that this would invigorate the base. And so because that's a real credible threat, it pushes people like Rob Bishop to try to see if there's some way to protect some land in exchange for some other areas.
Do you think this will be a campaign issue as we go down the road to November?
It is already a campaign issue in Utah among Utah officials. The question is, you know, is this something that will get national attention now? Is this something that the president looks at in his last 2 years when he's thinking more and more about his legacy? You know, I think that's kind of, we'll have to wait and see.
Hmm. Speaking of the road to November, we had a little bit of movement, a little bit of speculation stirred by some poll numbers that Democrat Doug Owens released. He's the Democrat running against Mia Love. Tell us more, Matt.
Yes. It's been just assumed that Doug Owens is a underdog in his race against Mia Love in Utah's 4th Congressional District, which right now is represented by Jim Matheson, who's retiring. And Owens released a poll that showed he's within 9 percentage points, 50 to 41. That's not remarkably close, but it's within striking distance enough to, that he has some hope that he can make this race competitive. And what his poll, what he wants to highlight in his poll is that when asked, each candidate was described in some very nice ways, the respondents favored him more than her, his centrist model over her conservative values. Now, he says, if I just introduce myself to these voters, I can win this race. The hard part is that's kind of in a vacuum. To say that Mia Love's just going to sit there and allow him to introduce himself to everybody and not respond in any way, that's not how campaigns work. But the point of this poll is not, you know, the biggest point of this poll is to tell people in the, from Doug Owens' perspective, that this is a serious race.
And that someone's running against Mia Love.
Right. And that he would like your financial help in this campaign. This is a fundraising move.
So Owens capitalizing on the poll numbers. Mia Love sort of got in on that too. She's using this as a fundraising tool for her.
Exactly. This is the way campaigns work now. Any news can be turned in both ways. So Doug Owens is saying, look, this race is competitive. Give me money. And Mia Love says, look, this guy says this race is getting competitive. Give me money. she sent out emails to her supporters asking for money for her emergency action fund, which I'm assuming just means her campaign account, saying that the Democrats are going to throw everything they can at her. I don't know if we've actually seen any evidence of that yet. No national Democratic group has bought an ad or in any material way supported Doug Owens, but she's using this poll as a way to get money for her own campaign as well.
Paul Raleigh, what do you think? Does Doug Owens have a chance?
No, he doesn't have a chance. I'm sorry, but he doesn't have a chance. He's going to lose. But it is interesting because when that poll first came out, I mean, Mia's campaign people, Dave Hansen and others, said this is bunk. Their numbers show something completely different and everything else. And now they're saying, oh, man, we better, you know, give us money because for our emergency account, you know. So Matt's right. It's all, you know, games that they play and everything else. But I just don't think that this race is going to be that competitive.
But why can't a Democrat hold on to a seat that is currently held by a Democrat?
Because I think the reason Jim Matheson decided not to run again is because he wants to run for the Senate or governor in 2016, and he didn't want to go into that race as a loser because he almost lost the last race. This district is skewed heavily toward Republicans. The only reason, I mean, Matheson, you know, was a pro. He was a veteran. People knew him. He was known as a moderate to conservative blue dog Democrat. So he was palpable. Doug Owens, his father was Wayne Owens, who was considered a very liberal Democrat. So Doug probably has that label on him as well. And I think that Matheson believed that he would lose if he tried to do it again this time. And so I just think that Doug's got too many strikes against him.
Redistricting, Robert.
Yeah. One interesting point that Paul made, I think, is that right now the problem is people don't know who Doug Owens is. I think the poll said something like 74% of those who were surveyed didn't recognize the name. And so he's got to make those introductions, but time is getting short for him to do that. The other, but on the flip side of this, I think it also showed, if the numbers are accurate, that there's fairly tepid support for Mia Love among the Republican base. I mean, this is a plus 14 Republican district, and if she's polling plus 9 and nobody knows the other guy, it kind of shows that even the Republicans in the district aren't necessarily, you know, all gung-ho about getting out and supporting Mia Love.
Mm. I think it's interesting in the story that we had that Owens didn't share everything about the poll. I mean, you have political observers saying you need to be a little suspicious about internal polls coming from campaigns. You know, they'll release, you know, what they want to release, what makes them look the best. The whole thing is continued political game playing on both sides.
Ben McAdams, I guess, tweeted when this poll was released.
Salt
Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams tweeted that this is the same firm that showed that he was going to lose by 15 points or was down by 15 points when he launched his campaign. So it's not necessarily a firm that I think his point was they're not going to spin it. They're not going to give you rosy numbers just to, you know, tease things up. But but you know, like Paul said, these polls are released for a reason, you know, and so there was obviously a clear agenda in putting these numbers out there.
Last week, Matt, we talked about a reshuffle in Owen's campaign staff. Is this sort of a shift in direction?
I think this is trying to get a shot in the arm. As Gerke said, that the window here is closing, and I think that what you're going to see is he needs some money to make this introduction, so he's using this poll as a way to fundraise. With the hope, I think, to do more TV ads. He's secured $300,000 worth of TV ads this fall, but he doesn't have the money to pay for it yet. So, you know, if he is going to introduce himself through a mass media way, he needs donors to come forward, and he needs some way to explain to them why they should give to him. And to say I'm within, you know, striking distance is the reason he's, you know, the reason he's going to give them.
Let's shift from congressional politics to local politics. The owner of a dog shot by Salt Lake City police turned down a settlement offer from the department this week. And Marissa, can you fill us in? What happened?
Absolutely. So the owner of a dog whose name was Geist turned down an offer from Salt Lake PD for $10,000 in reparations, basically, and damages to make up for Officer Brett Olson shooting this dog while he was searching for a missing child.
So Geist killed in his backyard
killed
as police
in his own backyard, yep.
Searching for this missing child. Police have maintained that it was protocol, that the dog was aggressive, the officer had no other choice. The owner of the dog, Sean Kendall, thinks that this whole thing could have been avoided if police had been better trained, right?
Exactly. Well, actually, there has just been some breaking news on this.
Breaking news.
So the police released an internal investigation that was conducted by Salt Lake Police Civilian Review Board on July 18th. And that had previously not been released. The results of that had been kept because they were waiting to try to see if they had to take any sort of disciplinary action against the officer. But I just saw on Twitter that they ruled that deadly force was necessary to prevent death or serious bodily injury to the officer from a dangerous animal, in this case being Geist the dog. And that is in line with police policy. It's you know, sort of a threshold that they evaluate when deciding whether or not excessive force was used, and they found that it wasn't.
What does internal review mean? Who does that?
So it's the Salt Lake County Police Civilian Review Board. It's non-officers, people who are not a part of the police department, who assess situations like this and make a finding.
Chief Burbank issued a statement this week saying that he was disappointed that Sean Kendall turned down this reconciliation offer. Do you think that he's willing to continue negotiating? Any sense, any indication of that?
I don't think he is. Our reporter, Harry Stevens, has been covering this pretty thoroughly, and he was getting two sides of the story from both Mr. Kendall and Chief Burbank. And Mr. Kendall was saying that, you know, this is what they offered me, but I'm sticking to my convictions, and, you know, you can't buy me off, basically. He was saying that he's not going to be happy until the police change their policy when it comes to animals to mirror what their policy is with humans in terms of use of force, and basically having the same requirements for using a weapon on an animal as you would on a person. Chief Burbank said, hey, we didn't make this offer on our own. You know, Mr. Kendall came to us and asked us for this money. And so we said, okay, here you go. And then he threw it in their face, rejected it very publicly, put it on Facebook. He spoke in the media about it very extensively. He's been very open about this entire affair. And I think that the chief is kind of feeling a little slighted and a little miffed that he was baited into saying, okay, we'll make you this offer, and then having it thrown back at him. So
In
a very public way. And I think the police are done negotiating. And with today's announcement that this officer has been cleared and his use of force was A-OK in the eyes of the police policy, I think that as far as Salt Lake Police is concerned, they have nothing more to do here.
Paul Riley, what are the chances that the police department will about face, change their policy to reflect lethal force only as a last resort in the case of animals?
Well, I don't think they'll change their policy. I mean, they've been, you know, this what Marissa just said, the findings of this review board said it was justified. So, I mean, they've got that leverage now to go forward. I mean, they're going to continue with a policy that if an officer feels like his life or his physical being is in danger, he has the right to defend himself and to shoot. I think that this the whole thing is just an unfortunate situation. You got to remember that when the officer went in the backyard, he was searching for a lost 3-year-old little boy. And, you know, I mean, I've had emails from people who want to weigh in, you know, just simply because I'm a columnist, and even though I haven't really covered this story, you know, who believe, you know, I mean, a 3-year-old little boy has got to take precedent over a dog, and if the dog was very threatening to this officer, they, you know, I think a lot of sentiment is that he had the right to shoot the dog. The opposition, you know, the people on the side of Geist have been very, very vocal. But I get the sense that the majority of the population probably would side with the officer in this case.
Mm. Well, it does have a lot of people asking the question, Robert, would I take the $10,000 for my dog?
Yeah, if somebody wants to shoot my dog, he's been getting up on the counter lately, and so I'd take the $10,000 for sure. In a heartbeat.
We're talking about the week's news. We invite you to chime in as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. Put your comments at sltrib.com. We'll be right back after another break. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me in studio, Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Marissa Lang, and Paul Raleigh. And you're welcome to join us at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Another big story this week was the solar fee, the Utah Public Service Commission getting an earful from opponents of a proposed fee on homeowners with solar panels. We're going to get to the hearing in just a second, but Matt Canham, can you explain just a little bit about this fee that's being pushed by Rocky Mountain Power?
Yes, Rocky Mountain Power wants to institute a $4.65 monthly fee on anyone who uses solar power. That's even if all of their bill goes through solar, they still want to use these people to pay this fee. And that is about 2,000 people, 2,000 households in Utah and
okay,
growing.
Okay, so it's tiny right now.
It's tiny. They have 700,000 customers at Rocky Mountain Power does. So this is 2,000, but it's an increasing group that are trying to move towards solar.
And what's the argument? Why?
Because the company is saying that even if you use solar, you still rely on their system occasionally when the solar isn't enough, and so you need to pay for the infrastructure costs that it takes to keep this system running. They also say that because your use of the normal electricity is sporadic, it shocks the system occasionally when this group of people suddenly need the normal power.
Okay. So this is not sitting well with a lot of alternative energy supporters, and they said so at a public hearing. Barry Goldwater Jr. was even there.
Right, yes. A former congressman and the son of a former presidential candidate. You know, the argument from these people is that solar is a benefit to the environment. It is a renewable resource. It's never going anywhere. And that a lot of these homes generate power. They generate more solar power than they can use. And that power goes into the Rocky Mountain Power system for free. That power, there's a study that this group pointed to that said that these people are providing $1.4 million a year in power to Rocky Mountain Power. Why are you making them pay a fee?
So instead of getting punished, they should be celebrated.
Right.
Okay. Well, so the organization that decides whether or not this fee is implemented is the Public Services Commission. Where are they in deciding? Do we have a sense?
So what happened this week is they had a public hearing. They've been getting public comments for a while. So far, they've got 11,000 comments.
So people care.
People really care about this issue. And what happened this week is you had dozens and dozens of people speak out against this fee. You had the company represent itself and say, you know, we need this as a way to pay for our infrastructure. Only one state in the union has done this, but there's more than one obviously considering it. Arizona put forward just such a fee, which might be why Barry Goldwater Jr. is interested in this. But this is now moving to Utah and will probably be a fight that happens in other states as solar becomes a bigger deal. I mean, even if it's just 2,000 customers, is 2,000 customers not paying that, you know, a big monthly fee to Rocky Mountain Power?
Paul Raleigh, what's your gut tell you? Is the Public Services Commission really going to implement a fee on people who are generating more power than they use?
You know, I can't predict what they're going to do. They are appointed by a conservative governor who seems to be sympathetic towards the traditional fuel companies and has gotten a lot of money from them in his campaigns. This is, you know, it seems to me to be a, you know, typical fight in a lot of ways. I can't say that Rocky Mountain is just trying to discourage, you know, the increase in solar power, but there seems to be this philosophical fight, and the traditional fuel companies and conservative politicians, people on the conservative side, seem to try and come up with the, you know, reasons and excuses why we can't go to this alternative, you know, these alternative fuels. When they had the big BP, you know, oil, you know, disaster and near, you know, near in the Gulf, and all that, and you saw the images of all these animals and that were covered with oil and dying. I remember on the right-wing radio and those people, they were saying, well, look at all the birds that get killed in windmills, you know. I mean, there's this natural, you know, pushback from the right against these alternative fuels. This might be part of that a little bit.
Kirky?
I was just thinking, I mean, in the last several years, the legislature has passed a number of incentives for alternative fuels, I mean, alternative fuel vehicles and for solar power. So I would be surprised if the Public Service Commission does go ahead and grant this fee, or at some point during this journey, I think the legislature will at least have hearings about it, have a hearing about it, and look at it. Because, as Matt mentioned, there has been a public outcry on it. It is an election year, and it is something that, frankly, I mean, state policy has been trying to encourage the use of these alternative energies. So, I think while it is in the Public Service Commission's court right now, I think the legislature will also have a say in it before it's over.
Certainly a story we will continue to follow at the Tribune. Let's move on to our final segment, the underplayed story of the week, the story that you think maybe have gone under the radar. We had a lot of big topics come up this week. Let's start with Matt Canham. What do you think?
Congress did something.
Congress did what? Oh,
yes,
what?
And you might have missed it because they're in the process of fighting over what to do with the children at the border. But in the middle of this fight, they passed a $17 billion deal to try to help the Veterans Administration. There has been a huge scandal over how long it's taken for our veterans to get the health care that they deserve. And some people have died in this wait. And this has been a problem that's happened for months, the scandal that has brewed, and nothing seems to have happened. And very quietly this week, they passed this bipartisan deal by huge margins that spent $17 billion that didn't offset any of it. What it did is it gave $10 billion to pay for veterans to get health care outside of the VA system from normal doctors that we go to. It put $5 billion into hiring new doctors and nurses at VA health clinics and allowed for 27 new facilities to be created. One interesting change is it allowed the new VA secretary to fire and demote executives who screwed this up. Now, I don't know why that power wasn't there before, but it's nice to know that they can actually punish people who have neglected to do their jobs.
Well, gosh, that is a ray of sunshine. Thank you, Matt, for that. I appreciate it. Okay, Marissa, what's your story of the week?
I'm going to bring us down again.
Oh, okay.
Lee Davidson's story about how Utah women are twice as likely as men to work low-wage jobs, and those low-wage jobs pay less than $10.10 an hour. I'm a woman, and I found this really interesting, particularly because the study pointed out that it was regardless of the amount of education that these women had, in a lot of cases, the women who were working these lower paying jobs than their male counterparts actually were more educated and more qualified. And, you know, I just thought that was really interesting. Women make up 44% of the Utah workforce, and yet they're working 65% of the state's lowest paying jobs.
You keep using this word interesting. I call it depressing.
It is depressing.
And sitting in a room with Marissa and Jennifer, I know that they're both more qualified than Matt and Paul and I, and they're probably getting about $10.10 an hour working at the Tribune.
Probably about that, yeah.
Damn you. Okay.
It's depressing. Now I'm really depressed.
Sorry, guys.
Paul Raleigh, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, I had one of my column items this morning was about a controversy going on out in Bluffdale, the Bluffdale Rodeo put on their website inviting kids. Next week is Rodeo Days and Bluffdale Western Days, and they have an event they actually had asked on a Harriman garage sale site if anybody would like to donate pets or sell them cheap so they could, and then they were going to put these pets in a pen and then kids under 11 could chase them around. We're talking about little chickens and kitties and things like that, and catch them, and then they could keep them. And these animal rights groups went pretty ballistic about that. And you know, got very upset. I talked to the rodeo chairwoman yesterday, who got very emotional. She says she's an animal lover, and they've done this before, and they've never got hurt, but they've decided to cancel the event just because of the reaction, from the animal rights groups.
And these were animals to be adopted anyway.
Well, she said that when she put the ad in the Harriman garage sale site, she was looking for animals that would, that were unwanted and would probably go to the pound anyway. And then this way, if they got caught by a kid in this little game that they had going, the kid could keep them so they'd have a home. And so that was her take. She got very emotional because apparently she told me that she's just been hammered, by these people, and people calling her a animal killer and an abuser and all this stuff. And so, but they've canceled the event now.
No good deed goes unpunished. Okay. Robert.
Before we leave cruelty to animals, I should clarify that earlier when I said I'd like somebody to shoot my dog, I was just joking.
Okay.
It was a bad
joke
on my part. And I don't send me your emails or your hate mail. I don't need that. The story that I thought maybe not underplayed, but it has a long ways to go, I think, that you'll want to keep an eye on is this story about the trustee for the Polygamous Trust who was implicated, I guess, in a prostitution sting or case. It's unclear. He hasn't gone to court yet. He said he was helping the woman financially. It's not clear if he was actually using the services, I guess I should say.
And so, but thus far, he has not been charged.
Thus far, he's not been charged. Yeah, that should be made clear. But I mean, I think you want to keep an eye on this one because it does have potential to sort of complicate the management of this trust, which is already this sort of growing and ongoing headache. And Nate Carlisle has been following this closely, and it looks like there's going to be at least potentially a bench warrant issued if he doesn't show up to his next court hearing. So, it has the potential to really throw a wrench into the unraveling, I guess, of this multi-million-dollar polygamous trust.
That's a very juicy story. You're right. We'll have to continue to follow that. Mine is a story that appeared in this morning's paper, a group of libertarians suing the state of Utah over the Common Core. That's the set of standards that was adopted by the state school board. We're going to hear a lot more about this as the lawsuit progresses, but sort of a new phase in the education reform conversation. Robert Gerke, Marissa Lang, Matt Canham, and Paul Raleigh, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for your time, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. We greatly appreciate KCPW's support of this program. We urge you to continue to contribute generously to keep KCPW a vital resource in this community. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.